One of the areas of the state that was the focus of the study I mentioned earlier, conducted by the Office of Surface Mining and the Army Corps of Engineers, was the Kaford Mountain area, which is near several mountaintop removal sites. The study found that the mining there could substantially increase flooding. Indeed, this was one of the areas hardest hit by the July 8th flooding. One resident of the Kaford Mountain area, from the town of Sylvester, Pauline Canterbury, was quoted in the Charleston Gazette as saying, quote, "Act of God, act of God. This is not an act of God. God put the mountains and the trees here to protect these valleys and the people who live in these valleys. Now they've taken the tops off the mountains. They've taken the trees away. They've taken from God's creation. There's nothing to protect us anymore." End quote. I spoke with Pauline Canterbury last week about the July 8th floods and the role mountaintop removal coal mining played.
Why don't you tell me what your experiences were with the flooding in early July?
Well, my experiences was, I live in the town of Sylvester, and which we got water here, but nothing compared to what a couple of the areas around us got, like Sand Creek and your Bugger Holler, up, which is up in Dorothy, which is close by here also. Mm-hmm. And I know that at the head of the Sand Creek Hollow and the Dorothy Hollow is your Kaford Mountainous area, where they have been mountaintop removing for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And I know that they have changed the water up there, the water flow, with the mountain removal, that's in progress up there. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, they changed the flow of the water, and they released it off into possibly like three different areas. Mm-hmm. And I know that they released part of that into Sand Creek, part of it into Bulger Holler, which is in Dorothy, and part of it into Cabin Creek. Mm-hmm. Now, I also know that in Sand Creek Hollow, that they have two holding ponds, and I know that holding pond number two broke because I have pictures of it. I have a tape of the holding pond number two that did rupture. Mm-hmm. It was full of logs. It was full of branches, debris, and when it broke, it just brought boulders, rocks, logs, debris, crushing down the mountains onto the people in the community of Sand Creek.
Wow.
And bringing the devastation with it everywhere it went. I mean, it destructed everything it came in contact with. And from talking with countless peoples in the Dorothy area, the same thing happened up there. Countless people said that they had three different walls of water that gushed out of that hollow. Well, a normal rainfall doesn't bring it in gushes. It's got to be something has to break at a particular time to make it all come at once. And, I mean, these are people that you can trust with what they tell you. They're not exaggerating. And these are people that have lived in this area from 50 to 70 years. And they've weathered floods here before. But we've never, ever had anything like the flood we had on July the 8th. Now, I know I have lived in this valley for 60 years. And I've never seen the destruction that we had here on July the 8th. And I definitely think the mountaintop removal is, and also the logging. You're going to have to blame the logging for it, too, because they're doing clean-cut logging, and that's leaving nothing on the mountains to hold the water back. And all of it together is just causing a total disaster on the people in southern West Virginia.
They do clear-cutting for the mountaintop removal,
They do the clear-cutting for the mountaintop removal. They go in and clear-cut the lumber first, and then they go in and do their core drilling, which tells them where the coal's at. And then they go in and shoot off the top of the mountain, and they fill in the valleys. And in filling in the valleys, they turn the water into different directions, the direction that they think that it should go.
Mm-hmm.
And so it puts more in a valley that has normally run in that valley.
Mm-hmm.
Under normal circumstances, the way nature set it up to do, and it's just causing havoc on top of havoc here.
Right.
I mean, we've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people now without homes.
Uh-huh.
And more hundreds that have got homes that are under big destruction, that they're going to have to repair and put back together.
Right.
And I definitely think that it's coming from a lot of it from the mountaintop removal, because I don't think they're strict enough with it. I don't think that they have made the companies be responsible, you know, be responsible to the people that are around the areas where they're, you know, they're mining it at. And it's just causing one terrible problem in southern West Virginia.
Now, I've read a lot of the newspaper reports about it, and so I heard that after the flooding, the inspectors from the Department of Environmental Protection cited a lot of the mines, a lot of the mining companies for infractions. But it sounded like, I don't know, when I hear the descriptions of what they have to do for mountaintop removal mining, I don't see how they could do it in a way that didn't create a lot of these problems.
Well, there really isn't any way you can do it. It's not going to cause a lot of problems, because what you're doing is you're changing Mother Nature's course. And any time you do that, you're going to have problems.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Are you going to have it right? I mean, are you going to do it right? Another thing I noticed about the tape that we have of the breakage of the dam up in the Sand Creek Hollow is the dam was not built like a dam is supposed to be built. You know, there's ways to build a dam that will make the dam safe.
Mm-hmm.
But this was only like boulders thrown into the valley and concrete poured over top of them and more boulders and more concrete and more boulders and more concrete, because they're strung all the way down the valley with boulders with pieces of concrete attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows you that that's possibly the way they've done it. And to me, that is not security enough.
Right.
And I mean, I'm not saying this from what I think. I'm saying it from what I've seen.
Right.
You know. So don't say much that I don't think I can back up.
Right.
People have just, in the coal fields, have just been pushed to the point where, I mean, you know, this is ridiculous. They're driving us from our homes. They're destroying our homes in more ways than one. I live in the town of Sylvester, and we have fought coal dust for going into our fourth year with no relief.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to talk about what your experience is with the mining itself, even before the flooding. I mean, can you feel the blasts from where you live? And
oh yeah,
uh-huh.
Oh yeah.
What's that like?
Well, now not so much right now as we did before, because it's moved a little bit away from us at the, you know, the present time. But I know when they blasted the mountain, which was just yards, maybe 2, 4, 6, maybe 200 yards from my house, they blasted the mountain off in order to put 2 loading tracks on for the Akron Mining Company.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, they filled up like 10 to 12 feet of the river that goes through this town, which is Big Coal River. And with that, in my estimation, is what caused a lot of the flooding in our town.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you take from one side of the river, if you take 10 to 12 feet, where's that water going to go except to the other side?
Right.
And it backed up into the low area of this town because of that. And we had damages to our homes, and you can't get anything for it. You file a suit, and they appeal you in court from now on to doomsday.
Right.
Which is another thing I think that this country needs to do, is to clamp down on that appeal law that we have. Because they can tie us up in court until their permits are over with and they're gone from here. It just seems like any way we turn, we're at a loss. We're the loser no matter what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't right. It isn't fair. We've worked all of our life to get where we are. The community I live in, 75% seniors. It's elderly people. And, I mean, this is destroying what they have left of their life.
Right.
And this is their life. It's all of it. You can't seem to get that across to our top officials. They want to turn a deaf ear to us or can totally ignore us, which I've had that happen to, and trying to speak with them, I've been totally ignored. And as if I don't know what I'm talking about. And I do.
Mm-hmm.
I have been in the coal fields all my life. I was born in the coal fields. My father was a miner. My husband was a miner. But never have I ever seen anything like this, that there's no concern or consideration whatsoever for the people.
Mm-hmm.
None. It's just let them do what they want to do, and it's just like they have give the operators free rein. You can do what you want to do anytime you want to do it, and nobody's supposed to open their mouth. When you know that's not the way to run a country. They're teaching our young people, well, you know, don't be honest. You're not going to get anywhere if you're honest. You know, take it. If you want it, take it. And I just don't think this is good. I don't think it's good for our state. I don't think it's good for our nation. I can get really wound up in this.
Yeah. Well, it's understandable. It's understandable.
I mean, you know. Well, I know because I have a house sitting here so full of coal dust that it just tears me all to pieces.
Yeah.
From one mining complex that was allowed to go in 600 feet from our homes. A stoker plant that does nothing but choke up coal dust all day long and night.
Right.
You know.
So you said that you've tried to sort of get responses from public officials.
We have been to DEP. We have been to Office of Air Quality. We have been to the Environmental Protection Agency. We have been everywhere we could think to go. I've even contacted the Secretary of the Interior in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and I've got a little response from him. We got about 2 weeks of relief from coal dust through him, but as soon as that was over, that 10-day inspection was over, it was right back again.
Hmm.
But, you know, it's just a never-ending battle.
So the, as far as the state officials go, it's that you think that they are just caving into pressure from the coal companies?
Well, you know, it seems like they have the feeling that when we walk in, you know, to see them, that we just want to be rid of mountaintop removal. It's not that as much as if you have it and it's safe, that's fine, but you got to make it safe to have it.
Right.
You know. Not only safe for the coal corporates, but safe for the people who live around that, too.
Mm-hmm. One last question. So these efforts that you've made to try to get some response from public officials, are you part of any group, or are you doing this as an individual?
Well, yes. Well, I'm doing a lot as an individual, as a spokesman for the town of Sylvester. And because, as I quoted before, so many of our people are elderly. They're not able to fight this battle. They don't have the health to fight this battle. And but I have joined some of the organizations in order to get some help from them, too.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, not only myself, but several of the other people in town have joined in with them, too, in order to try to get some help. Because as an individual, we have found out we are not getting the first base.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the recent floods are going to get a lot more people involved?
Yes, I really think it will get more involved than what we have now. I think it's going to make people rise because they're going to see their, I mean, you know, our lives are, well, the thing of it is now they have went so far to the point that our lives are in danger.
Mm-hmm.
In this valley right now, where I live, we have 4 slurry impoundments. Now, you know what I mean when I say slurry impoundments.
Well, yeah, I'm learning about it, but maybe you can just tell me.
Well, you know, that's where they wash the coal, and the slurry, the waste products from it are transferred onto the mountain by a belt line and put into these slurry impoundments that are dammed between 2 mountains.
Uh-huh.
And we have 4 that is in the close area where I live that are on the high-risk danger list right now with OSHA, O-S-H-A.
Uh-huh.
And we have in our river, which is Big Coal River, that runs through this area right now, is listed as one of the most dangerous rivers there is in the United States right now for contamination.
Because of those slurry.
Because of the runoff of those impoundments, which those impoundments hold 60 different chemicals in them. These mines let them run off. Now, they run off through rainy time. They let them run off. And see, they're supposed to only let so much of it into your river system. And but they let them off at the times when it rains or on weekends when they think people's not looking at the river,
mm-hmm.
and they will let it out and into the river.
Wow.
In order to take it out of the impoundments, because so many of them are getting up to the top part of them and they are full.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not supposed to do that because, see, what part comes into the river is supposed to go through what they call 3 holding ponds. That it comes to one, it settles. It comes to another one and settles. It comes to the third one and settles again. Then it's supposed to be clear enough to come into the river.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's supposed to be set up, but it isn't done that way.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, about a week and a half ago, I got a picture of one coming out at the Okra Mining Complex here at Sylvester, where I live, and letting slurry out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after we'd had a rainy day.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually when you can catch them. So, I mean, you know, we're at the point now where our lives are in danger, and the bad part is that this valley has no escape routes. If one of those slurry impoundments would break, it would just tell us all goodbye because we're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility is there.
Mm-hmm.
And all this together with what has had the floods and all, you know, It's made a very uneasy feeling in the community, and it's always been a wonderful community to live in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a coal mining community. There aren't riches here, but there's been lots and lots of love here, and that's the main ingredient of life.
Mm-hmm.
That was Pauline Canterbury of Sylvester, West Virginia. For more information about mountaintop removal coal mining, visit the website of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition at www.ohvec.org. For Ken Ward Jr.'s articles about the July flooding, including excerpts from the previously unreleased study from the Office of Surface Mining and the Army Corps of Engineers, visit the website of the Charleston Gazette at www.wvgazette.com.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Adry Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. And the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken, then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. When I die, let my ashes float down the Green River. Let my soul roll on up to the Rochester Dam. I'll be halfway to heaven with paradise waiting, just 5 miles away from wherever I am. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg?
Recent discoveries have shown that even as sea levels rise as a result of warming, fresh water sources are being depleted by evaporation. The article I'm about to read was from the August 12th edition of the New York Times. It's titled, U.S. Freshwater Stocks Depleted by Warming. Near vast bodies of water, land lies parched. South Elgin, Illinois. People who live at the emerald edge of this Chicago suburb have noticed that something seems out of whack this year. The water that once sustained a little pocket of life, beavers, muskrats, frogs, and cattails, has disappeared, and the land around it looks puckered, despite a wet spring. A dried-up wetland was odd enough in a township that gets as much rain as Seattle every year, in a region where floods are a fact of life and the summer humidity can make it seem like being inside the mouth of a dog. but it could foretell something bigger, even more out of character, according to a study that has stunned people in the Chicago metropolitan area. Parts of six counties in a region that borders one of the world's largest freshwater sources, Lake Michigan, could be in for serious water shortages within 20 years, the report by a regional planning commission said. And while the June report surprised people who live near a lake system that contains one-fifth of the world's surface fresh water, it did not surprise a handful of corporations that have been saying that water will be for this century what oil was for the last. This year, with shortages appearing in places that have never doubted the future of their supply, many parts of the country have discovered water may indeed be a commodity more precious than oil. Cities are cutting deals to siphon water from far away. Destinies are being reshaped and species put in peril by new plans to dip straws into underground rivers or withered rivers. A general warming trend, sprawl that covers the sponge of land that normally replenishes the nation's vast underground reservoirs, and the growing demands of agriculture and expanding cities are the reasons most often cited for accelerated water shortages. The problem, which used to be limited to the arid West, has dominated community concerns in some of the most unlikely places. Florida's reservoirs below and above ground are badly depleted and becoming briny with saltwater seepage. The water shortage is so bad in parts of the state, despite a recent tropical storm, that people have been hauled into court and fined for violating strict water rationing standards. In Kentucky, more than half of the state's 120 counties ran short of water or were on the verge of shortages this year before heavy rains brought relief. In the Pacific Northwest, where water is the master architect of a lush land, too little water has been promised to too many people, leaving farms and wildlife to wither in places like the Methow Valley in Washington or Klamath Falls, Oregon, precursors of coming water clashes, according to many experts. And a report released Thursday found that even in the suburbs around Seattle, on the wet side of the Cascade Mountains, demand for water is outstripping supply, raising the prospect of shortages within 20 years. Some major American cities in the Southwest, including El Paso, San Antonio, and Albuquerque, could go dry in 10 to 20 years. But a number of towns in New England and the well-watered half of the Midwest are also facing the prospect of running out of water in a generation's time. Here in the Great Lakes region, a fourth year in a row of declining water levels has caused millions of dollars in losses for shipping companies, marinas, and other businesses, and prompted further restrictions on future water withdrawals for expanding suburbs. A lot of people just can't believe we may be running out of water, living this close to the Great Lakes, said Sarah Narenberg, a water engineer with the Northeastern Illinois Planning Commission, which conducted the study on shortages. The federal government, which controls water to 31 million people in the West but has far less control elsewhere, has offered little guidance for struggling regions. In the absence of a single power broker, a veritable free-for-all has emerged, with private companies and individual states and cities cutting their own deals. In northeast Kansas, for example, the water shortage is so severe that state officials are discussing plans to build a pipeline costing as much as $200 million to the Missouri River to keep the area from going dry. But most of the water in the Missouri is already spoken for, other users say, setting up the kind of conflict that is endemic to the West. Some of the other big rivers that have long sustained American communities, from the Ipswich in Massachusetts to the Rio Grande in the Southwest, are running thin. The Rio Grande, drawn down by farmers and fast-growing cities in New Mexico and Texas, is down to a bare trickle where it snakes through Big Bend National Park in Texas. It is so braided with chemicals and salt that fish, birds, and mammals that use it are dying, park rangers say. The problem in Chicago's suburbs is typical of the predicament facing other traditionally wet areas. Water looks abundant here in Kane County, for example, which lies between the nation's biggest river, the Mississippi, and one of its biggest lakes, Michigan. But appearances are deceptive. Most of the nation's fresh water, about 60%, is out of sight. It comes from below ground in rivers and pools known as aquifers. These aquifers are being depleted at the same time that surface water in lakes and rivers is stressed by growing demands and heat. Many of the nation's biggest aquifers, such as the 175,000 square mile Ogallala in the southern plains, have long been depleted by farming. To the east, the underground river that brings water to the nation's most bountiful rice crop in Arkansas will be dry in less than 15 years, hydrologists say. Global warming, which has been blamed for increased evaporation rates of surface water and low mountain snowpack that feeds major rivers like Colorado and the Columbia, is cited by many scientists as the biggest single culprit in some of the emerging water shortages. Last December, federal researchers said a gradually warming climate could reduce levels in the Great Lakes by 5 feet at the end of the century, but they also noted that the lake levels fluctuate regardless of climate changes. And a strict agreement signed by the governors of all the states surrounding the Great Lakes and two Canadian provinces has made it unlikely any new communities can tap into the big basin of fresh water. Sprawl is coming in for its share of blame as well. In the Chicago area, hydrologists say land that would normally soak in water and replenish aquifers has been paved over, effectively blocking water needed to refill the underground basins. In past shortages, people tapped into Lake Michigan. When Chicago was coming of age, it reversed the flow of the Chicago River, draining water out of Lake Michigan instead of into it. Now, the so-called collar counties around Chicago, which are expected to add 1.3 million people over the next 18 years, find that the lake is off limits and supplies below ground are not being adequately replenished. It was the prospect of these growing national water scarcities, combined with a global problem in which nearly a billion people do not have access to clean drinking water, that prompted Enron, the Houston-based energy conglomerate, to enter the water business. Already, bottled water costs more than gasoline in most stores, but nearly 90% of all municipal water systems are publicly owned. Enron, the nation's number one marketer of natural gas and electricity, saw water as a commodity that would eventually be deregulated, just as electric power was in California. If that happened, Enron would be free to buy and sell water to the highest bidders, no different from oil or megawatts. The company set up a website to trade water and went prospecting for liquid gold. The people at Enron followed a trail already blazed by a fellow oil man, T. Boone Pickens, who has been buying underground water from farmers in hopes of selling it to parched cities in Texas, and the Bass brothers, who bought 46,000 acres in the desert of Southern California, only to be stymied by legal and technical problems over underground water rights. In the next 10 years, the United States will experience serious water shortages, Rebecca Mark, chief executive officer of Enron's water division, Azurix, told business leaders in Texas 2 years ago as she outlined plans to lay a claim to a global industry worth about $400 billion. At the same time, another top Enron executive, Roger Fragua, told a congressional subcommittee, quote, "Just as Enron led the evolution of natural gas and electric restructuring, we are excited to take a similar role in the water industry," unquote. But Enron discovered that water was not as easily corralled as oil or gas. Public agencies and consumer groups, many critical of Enron's role in the debacle of energy deregulation in California, fought the company and others pushing for privatization. This year, after 2 years of foraging for water, Enron's water spin-off collapsed, reporting losses of more than $300 million, and retreating from the stock market. A spokesman for the company, Keith Michelli, said Enron was disappointed that the global market for water did not develop for us, close quote. Other companies, most based in Europe, have had more success. I think we're moving toward privatization, but water is different than oil. It's so much more emotional, said Deborah Coy, a water market expert at Schwab Capital Markets. Look what's happening. You've got shortages all over the world. Mr. Pickens plans to pump water from the Ogallala and pipe it into cities in Texas. In Southern California, a private company, Cadiz, is negotiating with the agency that provides water for 17 million people to store water from the Colorado River in a Mojave Desert aquifer, then sell it back in dry years. The plan has won approval from the board of the Metropolitan Water District, which has been draining water from far-flung places throughout California since the early 20th century. But environmentalists oppose it, saying it could suck dry the vital springs that keep bighorn sheep and desert tortoises alive in the Mojave. The urban areas are going to get the water they need, said Thomas J. Graff, a water expert at Environmental Defense. The real battle is at the margins between the environment and agriculture. Farms use a majority of American water. At a time when most farms are subsidized by the government, failing to make money in a global market, many water experts say it is inevitable that water to meet future needs will have to come from agriculture. The same amount of water it takes to support just 10 farm jobs can support 100,000 high-tech jobs, said Peter Glick, a water expert with the nonprofit Pacific Institute in Oakland, California. An interjection here, as I can't let this insane thinking pass without comment. These statements by so-called water experts reveal with precision the incapacity of market capitalism to solve the problems that its greed has created. Perhaps the expert thinks that people can eat computer components instead of food. Why are the urban areas going to get the water they, quote, need, so that people can hose down their driveways? Who has decided that it is agriculture that must be pitted against the environment, while millions of gallons of water are used to mop to surgical cleanliness the floors of countless malls selling overpriced clothing and gizmos to bored consumers? It is the global market that is the problem, not the farming. Back to the article. Some are concerned that the fight over water will come down to a numbers game, involving mass transfers from one group to another and ultimately leaving out wildlife in wetlands and along rivers. Already, in some places of North America, we have freshwater species extinction rates that rival those of the tropics, said Sandra Postel, an author of two books on water and director of the Global Water Policy Project in Amherst, Massachusetts. What worries me a lot is when we start to think that drinking water can only come from a bottle, Ms. Postel said. We're not just talking about something like oil or pipes and transfers. We're talking about a public good, something that keeps everything alive. Certainly here in the suburbs, facing an advance guard of new houses, some longtime residents said they realized the value of water only when it was gone. We were just appalled by what happened this spring, said Sue Schudel, who has lived in South Elgin for 45 years. The cattails were all dead. The ponds dried up. We'd never seen it like this. And that was from the August 12th edition of the New York Times, an article, U.S. Freshwater Stocks Depleted by Warming. Alan Nogi, director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Energy Program, spoke with Mind Over Matter's Mike McCormick on the Bush Energy Plan, Alternative Energy, and the UCS latest report, Clean Energy Blueprint.
My name is Alan Nogi. I'm the Energy Program Director of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Been working for over 20 years in doing research and advocacy around trying to develop clean energy sources for our electricity supply in the United States.
You've recently co-authored a report entitled the Clean Energy Blueprint, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about that and tell us about its connection to the current Bush Energy Plan.
The Bush Energy Plan focused primarily on developing new sources of energy supply, fossil fuels and nuclear power, and developing hundreds of thousands of miles of new gas transmission lines and distribution lines and electric power lines to move those new supplies around. What the Bush team did not look at was the opportunity to continue to improve the efficiency of our energy-using technologies and to develop new renewable energy sources. And our study, Clean Energy Blueprint, focused on what we could achieve if we really established national policies to make energy conservation and energy efficiency and renewable energy priorities.
And tell me about some of your findings.
What we found is, first, we could get to at least 20% of our electricity supply from renewable energy by the year 2020. That's up from 2% today and 2.8% that the Bush National Energy Policy forecasts we will be at in the year 2020. So we basically, with some real solid support, we can greatly diversify our sources of energy using these abundant domestic supplies that also have very little or no pollution. And this is one of the most exciting developments, really, in our findings. In addition, we find that combined with energy efficiency policies, we can actually have an energy system that will save us money relative to today and relative to business as usual, while at the same time reducing the environmental impact of the system. We found that, in fact, energy savings would continue to grow and reach about $65 million a year in the year 2020 relative to business as usual.
Why do you think that you guys came upon this information that the Bush administration hasn't been moving towards conservation?
Well, we studied policies that that really they certainly had the information about. These are policy proposals that actually are on the table now in Congress, and most of them were even included in a study by the five national energy laboratories last November called Clean Energy Futures, which looked at most of the policies that we looked at, but not implemented to quite the same extent. For example, the five national labs only looked at what would the costs and benefits be of going to 7.5% renewables by 2010. We took that and we extended it to 20% by 2020. So these are all policies that the Bush team should and could have known about if it had only looked. Unfortunately, there's no evidence that they made any attempt to study how far we could improve energy efficiency and how much we could develop new renewable energy supplies. There's no analysis of it in their plan at all, unfortunately. And it seems to be driven really just by ideological considerations and determination to do the best by the energy supply industries that, after all, both of them, both the president and vice president, came from.
If anything, it seems there's quite a bit of disdain amongst the Bush administration for the whole concept of conservation and renewables.
Yes, well, they're starting to learn from the polls, which have shown that people are really unhappy with their ignoring and belittling energy conservation, and their rhetoric is really starting to improve. And just the other day, they did in fact propose some new spending on energy efficiency that they hadn't before. But by and large, it's only their rhetoric that's changing. We haven't seen any new proposals to increase renewable energy development. They have said that they'd be interested in looking at such proposals and in reviewing them. So far, it's only words. And the only actions that are on the table are actually a 50% proposed budget cut for research and development of new solar, wind, geothermal energy sources, and 50% budget cuts for some very important energy efficiency programs in buildings and to help industry become more efficient in its use of energy. And those actions really belie the changing rhetoric.
That just seems outrageous to me that they would do cuts. I mean, here we have clearly showing we've got a nation, if not a world, that is hungry for more energy, and yet one of the very things that potentially could relieve us of that, they're cutting back on.
It's really hard to explain, other than, unfortunately, the most cynical political view of it, that they've been influenced by their backgrounds with the energy industry and by campaign contributions. Because even the national energy policy that the administration published has tremendous examples of how much past investments in energy efficiency have saved the economy. In fact, they calculate that if it hadn't been for the codes and standards and efficiency investments made in the last 20 years, that we would be using a third to a half more energy than we are today to get no extra benefit for the economy. We would just be wasting hundreds of billions of dollars in needless energy expenditures. And yet, amazingly, rather than propose to continue the progress that we've made improving these technologies, they actually propose to cut the budgets. Right, same with renewable energy. They cite the fact that the costs for generating electricity from the wind and the sun has come down by 80 to 90% in the last two decades, largely as a result of the tremendous research and development that's gone on in the United States. And yet they propose cutting funding for those programs in half. It's really sad. We now see much more activity going on developing renewable energy sources in Japan and in the European Union than we do in the United States. And these are technologies that we developed but are now losing our leadership on. We've got to get it back.
I had the impression over the last couple decades that the technologies that we were developing for the renewables were actually being bought up fairly rapidly as soon as they came onto the market by the very energy corporations now that are denying that these things are even competitive.
Well, actually, a lot of big energy corporations have made investments and have bought some smaller renewable energy companies. And there was a time when that was happening in the 70s and the early 80s, and then some of the larger companies that swallowed up the smaller ones shut down those programs. But now I think we're seeing some real serious investment and interest in some of the major companies like BP, for example, Enron, which have been sinking some, beginning to sink some real money into renewables. And we certainly do support policies to help the smaller businesses and enable individual households to use these technologies cost effectively. But the big companies can play an important role in helping to really achieve economies of scale and driving down the costs if they invest seriously. And we're very hopeful that with the active support from the federal government, they will be interested in doing that. I think part of the problem in the 1980s is you saw the federal government under President Reagan completely abandon investments in developing alternative energy technologies. And ironically, if we had continued in the direction that was started in the late 70s, In fact, we really wouldn't be needing to look for a lot new fossil fuel supplies today.
So could you go into briefly the individual renewable energy sources and talk about their weaknesses and strengths?
Sure. I think the most exciting developments recently have been in the area of wind power. It's now the fastest growing technology in the world, energy technology in the world. And in fact, even in the United States, in the last year, we saw over 1,000 megawatts of new wind turbines be installed in states as diverse as Minnesota, Texas, Colorado, Alaska, New York State. We're really starting to see wind energy development all around the country. And that's because the costs have come down from about 30 to 40 cents a kilowatt hour in 1980, to where it's now in the best wind sites between 3 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour. And that's actually, today, that's competitive with natural gas prices and with the price of power from a new coal plant. So wind is really in place to take off. Now, obviously, wind doesn't generate electricity around the clock, only when the wind blows. And that factors into the economic calculations. But we need to supplement that with additional sources like biomass, which is using energy from plants, which, after all, just store solar energy through photosynthesis that is then released and can be used again when the plants are burned or converted into electricity through a chemical reaction like in a fuel cell. So we're seeing the beginning of development of new perennial crops to be used as energy crops, fast-growing perennials like switchgrass in the Midwest or willow and poplar trees in the Northeast, which can be done cleanly and efficiently and ultimately cost-competitively, we think, with fossil fuels. Geothermal is another energy source where we have tremendous potential, particularly in the western states, basically tapping the heat of the earth to make steam and generate electricity. And, of course, solar is also, it's another intermittent source like wind. It's only available when the sun is out, clearly a disadvantage. But on the other hand, it tends to be most productive at the time when we most need electricity, and that is when all the air conditioners are running. That tends to be the time these days when most utilities have their peak electricity demand, and that's also when the sun shines brightest. So there's a really good fit there as far as promoting reliability. The costs for solar electricity still need to come down a lot in order to be competitive. We've made great progress, but still need dramatic cost reductions. With economies of scale in manufacturing and more research and development, we think those costs can come down. And what we need is slow, steady investment in the technology in order to achieve those economies of scale. It's very exciting, and there's been a lot of progress, and we need support from the federal government to continue that progress.
Do you think with renewables that the primary push for their use is at an individual level, or is it mixed? It's also at a utility industrial level as well?
Really both. You know, we think there's real potential for solar energy in particular on individual homes and offices and buildings. We had a million solar roof program coordinated by the Department of Energy that has been making tremendous progress. A number of states in particular have started to really help homeowners and businesses afford solar energy through new renewable energy programs. And that's really helping to drive development there. There's also small wind turbines that are available for use in locations that have pretty good winds. But a lot of the really big progress that's been made is with utility scale installations. The new wind energy turbines that really are economical are very large machines, you know, that are capable of basically generating enough electricity in wind farms to serve hundreds of thousands of customers. And they can't be sited everywhere. They can only go in locations where there really are good winds. But we're finding that there are lots of places in the country that are like that, particularly in the Midwest, where farmers are becoming increasingly enthusiastic about the potential to site wind turbines on their land and earn additional revenues.
Talk about briefly, if you would, the negative aspects of, let's just focus on solar and wind, because in, let's say, letters to the editors and different papers across the country, whenever people bring up using solar or wind, then there seems to be a flurry of negative letters coming in, one saying with wind, oh yeah, but they're going to kill all the birds with those turbines, and the other saying that the solar is both too expensive and that the very chemicals that make up the solar cells themselves are toxic and we can't really get rid of them. Could you address that?
Sure. Well, we'll start with solar. First of all, there are some toxic chemicals used in solar manufacturing, but they don't enter the environment unless you were to take your solar panels, which are quite expensive, and shatter them into little bits and throw them around. In fact, the toxic materials can be entirely contained and recycled, and it is as close as we have to an absolute zero emission process for generating electricity. With wind turbines, it's really remarkable that a number of conservative think tanks in the last couple of years have become these great defenders of birds from wind turbines and the attack of the wind turbines all over the country. All of these conservative groups that have never expressed any interest in protecting birds from the primary threats to birds, which includes transmission towers and cellular towers and skyscrapers and the biggest threat to birds of all, house cats. In fact, in the entire world, there is only basically two sites that have proven to be a problem for birds, one in California and one in Spain, both of which happen to be poorly sited where there's fairly significant raptor populations. And in those cases, there have been some problems, and the developers are working on new designs to get around those problems. And now, any wind sighting studies carefully avoid any areas where there's really sensitive bird habitat or raptors. There's no serious problem, basically, between wind and birds. It is a manufactured issue by some conservative think tanks that basically have always been big promoters of fossil fuels and nuclear power.
You just brought up nuclear power, and that is certainly something that has been included in the Bush administration's energy plan. I'm wondering if you could address that.
Sure. It was really a big surprise to a lot of people that the plan did provide a big focus on nuclear energy. It's kind of interesting that that's actually an area that one of the conservative think tanks, the Cato Institute, and ourselves, the Union of Concerned Scientists, have a very large area agreement of. And that is that, you know, we've sunk hundreds of billions of dollars into the nuclear industry and the fossil industry over the years. Many, many, many tax breaks for nuclear power, federal exemption from having to buy private liability insurance, the federal government subsidies for processing the nuclear fuel. This is a technology that has been on corporate welfare from day one of its existence and still hasn't been able to produce a competitive product. Yes, some of the nuclear plants today are economical if you only look at their operating costs, but never have paid back for their construction costs. And there are now some new designs that are being floated where the proponents claim that they will be safer and more economical. But so far, they're just designs on paper. There's actually no working prototypes anywhere in the world. So we think that the administration's focus on this is really largely PR and that not much will come of it, although it may be that a couple of companies try to build some new nuclear plants as a result.
Address, if you would, the spin that comes along with the proposal for more nuclear plants, that nuclear energy does not contribute to global warming.
It's true that nuclear energy does not generate carbon dioxide emissions in the course of generating electricity. In fact, there are a lot of carbon dioxide emissions associated, however, with the production of nuclear fuel, where the refining facilities are actually powered today by a couple of the dirtiest coal plants in the entire United States. In addition, though, and most importantly, nuclear power has its own set of risks and environmental problems. Of course, you know, despite decades and decades of research and billions of dollars of funding, we still don't have a solution to the nuclear waste disposal problem. You know, it's partly political, yes, and it's partly technical. Trying to find a fail-safe mechanism for guaranteeing that these wastes remain isolated from the environment for tens of thousands of years is an extremely challenging problem and one that simply hasn't been solved. And with all the nuclear technologies that we have today, there is the risk of catastrophic accidents. Basically, a nuclear accident is capable of killing tens of thousands, up to 100,000 people at a given plant site, as well as rendering large areas permanently uninhabitable. And the real issue is, why do we want to take that risk if there's technologies available that are cheaper, cleaner, and don't have those kind of catastrophic risks? Our feeling is, before we give nuclear power a second chance, we ought to give energy efficiency and renewables a first chance.
I'm wondering if you can, again, talk about the results of your report, as well as tell people how you think to best get involved with shifting our current energy policy towards what you're recommending.
Sure. Yeah, our report found that we could reduce carbon dioxide emissions, which are the primary contributor to global warming that threatens to really destabilize our climate. We could cut those emissions by over 40% from business as usual projections through the combination of energy efficiency and renewables. In addition, we could cut the emissions of sulfur dioxide, which is the primary cause of acid rain, and nitrogen oxides, a primary contributor to smog, by over 25%. And at the same time, save people money. Cumulative savings of over $150 billion over the next 20 years by a program to really increase our investment in energy efficiency and in renewable energy, to require electric utilities to gradually ramp up their use of renewable energy sources. And all we have to do in order to achieve this is basically enact a number of bills which are pending in Congress that would set new standards for energy efficiency and renewables and provide new funding for those clean energy technologies. So it really is a political battle, and it's one that people have to get engaged in if we're going to hope to get that new investment. Because unfortunately, there's a lot of entrenched energy companies that benefit hugely from fossil fuel exploration and use, from nuclear power generation and use. And those are the companies that basically had the unfettered access to Vice President Cheney and his task force to develop the plan. There wasn't a single representative of any renewable energy technology in the administration's task force. And if we're going to make progress in this area, people have to contact their elected officials and urge them to increase funding for research and development of these technologies, to provide tax credits for these technologies that are at least equivalent to the kinds of tax credits that fossil fuels get, and to set new standards for energy efficiency and renewable energy. That's what's going to get us a clean energy future.
You've been obviously following these issues for a long time. What do you think about the concept of if, at let's say the federal, national level, that things aren't going our way, of communities banding together and perhaps creating their own, let's say, smaller size utilities of solar and wind power to service those communities themselves?
In fact, that is happening today. And it's a very encouraging trend. While unfortunately we don't see the leadership right now at the federal level, we see an enormous amount of activity happening in cities and towns and in states, where we see that local companies are making these investments, where citizens in Massachusetts, in Ohio, in California are aggregating together to basically develop clean new energy systems, and where a growing number of states have enacted both new funding sources for energy efficiency and for renewables and new minimum standards for their electric companies. Just in the last few years, 13 states have enacted new renewable energy standards requiring their utilities to provide a small but growing part of their power from renewable energy. So what we certainly need that kind of activity to continue. We need lots of new initiatives at the local level and the state level. But ultimately, if we're going to really solve our national environmental problems, if we're going to avoid serious, serious environmental issues from global warming, we have to have leadership at the national level, and we have to get our elected officials to act.
And finally, where can people read the report that you've produced and find out more about your organization?
Our report is published on our website, which is www.ucsusa.org. And we have an energy section of our website, along with clean vehicles and food and environment sections and the other issues that we work on at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And our report is posted there along with lots of supplemental information about these technologies and about policy initiatives at the state and federal level. And there are ways directly for people to get involved on the website at www.ucsusa.org.
That was Alan Nogi, director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Energy Program.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Just like